From Kentucky to New Mexico, Utah to Massachusetts, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, China has emerged as the top global economic and military competitor to the United States. Wei Fengyang from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here to talk about the current state of U.S.-China relations. In his address to Congress, President Joe Biden proposed yet another massive multi-trillion dollar spending plan. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Biden administration's so-called infrastructure plan attempts to justify spending $100 billion on broadband capacity. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains why this is a bad idea. And Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council talks about congressional reapportionment on his debut American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. China and the United States compete on a number of levels, and American policies toward the communist nation have been in flux in recent years. To learn more, we turn to Weifeng Yang. Weifeng is a senior research fellow with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Weifeng, welcome to American Radio Journal. Let's begin, Weifeng, with having you tell us a bit about the current state of relations between the United States and China. President Trump, of course, viewed China as one of the biggest competitors to our country. Not quite sure where the Biden administration is going, but your thoughts on the state of affairs between us and China.
I think after 4 years of President Trump's administration, we have seen now, in terms of U.S.-China policy, and two experiments. One is the two decades before President Trump, in which U.S. was pursuing some sort of a romantic engagement in terms of economic relations with China. And the consequence of that was a lot of national security concerns were surfacing when President Trump came to office. The 4 years under President Trump, I think the United States tried another experiment, which is to entertain some form of decoupling. So the tariffs war is a typical policy in that direction, with the goal of changing the Chinese behavior that we consider were concerning our national security. So now we're at a crossroads because the romantic engagement seems to be too naive and the decoupling strategy seems to be not working. So I think this is where we are at, to find the task for the Biden administration is to find the bliss point, so to speak, between too much engagement and too little engagement.
Working its way through Congress is something called the Strategic Competition Act of 2021. Give us a little bit of background, please, on what that act involves.
I think it's a sweeping act that involves a lot of items. So just to name a few, there's a concern about supply chain security, mostly because of COVID-19, that the United States realized in some parts of the global supply chain, we might be relying too much on supplies from China. So that's one item. The other is on the relations between the United States and Taiwan and how to pursue a more stronger tie between the U.S. and the island. And then there's the sanctions on the Chinese tech companies. And there's also this new what's called the Countering Chinese Influence Fund, which is supposed to inform the American public what exactly the Chinese influence is in our day-to-day lives.
In terms of that influence on our day-to-day lives, there are a number of different areas where that does occur. And let's talk about economics, Weifeng. President Trump had put a number of tariffs on Chinese goods coming into the United States in order, at least theoretically, to protect American companies. Are those tariffs still in place? And would be interested in your view as to how well they have worked.
They are still in place. In fact, toward the end of former President Trump's term, the U.S. government put out a set of China measures toward the last few weeks of his time, and those measures are largely kept by President Biden, including the tariffs. Now, I think the tariffs are not working as intended because we didn't see any substantial change in terms of Chinese behavior. It's still aggressive over the South China Sea, over Taiwan Strait, entertaining the idea of invading the island, and also disinformation and propaganda efforts overseas, outside of China, are still going strong. And so I think the terrorists are not achieving the goals. Sanctions might be. I'm guessing that's why this act is emphasizing more on sanctions rather than terrorists. And so I think the Biden administration should lift all those terrorists and pursue more effective means like sanctions.
Another area where we have had conflict with the Chinese government is in the area of intellectual property rights. This so-called Strategic Competition Act of 2021, does it in any way address intellectual property rights and the fact that the Chinese quite frequently violate them?
I think it is, at least in terms of what we can see now from the text of the bill, it's aiming towards sanctioning the semiconductor industries, most importantly. And that's because the violation of intellectual properties is happening on a day-to-day basis, because one way the Chinese economy and the Chinese technology has been trying to catch up with the frontier where I think the U.S. is at is through all sorts of legal and illegal reverse engineering and cyber espionage, where they try to basically steal the technology. Sometimes it was legal, but oftentimes it was not. And I think the sanctions on the semiconductor industry was precisely because the Chinese were trying to catch up on that sector. And the U.S. government is trying to make the illegal copying strategy harder and harder for the Chinese companies.
In terms of the military threat that China does pose to the United States, Wei Feng, have you seen any movement in the early days here of the Biden administration toward shoring up the United States militarily? And that can be both with conventional weapons, cyber warfare, et cetera. And is any of that included in this Strategic Competition Act?
The Strategic Competition Act doesn't specifically address the military actions, as far as I understand. But what we could tell, actually, is that my research at the Mercatus Center focuses on monitoring Chinese propaganda, domestic propaganda inside China, and from there, based on what the Chinese government is saying, to predict what they might do. And in fact, what we have detected since last year, a year ago, was the unusual emphasis on China's military power, which turns out a year later to be consistent with the increased military activities we saw near the Taiwan Strait. And the U.S. obviously has increased the activities over there proportionally, making a gesture of possibly defending Taiwan. So I think all of these were coming out from last year, and what we are seeing now shouldn't be any surprise if we really listen to what the Chinese government is saying, even to their own people.
We have been talking with Wei Feng Yang, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And Wei Feng, tell us a little bit about Mercatus. Also, where can folks go on the web if they'd like to learn more about U.S.-Chinese relationships and all the various research papers that you produce?
Mercatus Center is a nonprofit organization policy research center based with the George Mason University. And scholars like me at Mercatus Center, what we do is we bring insights from academic research to inform various policy making, and including in this particular case, the U.S. policy toward China. And the work that I do, I mentioned about propaganda analysis, is under what we call the Policy Change Index. And if you would like to learn more about what we can draw from monitoring Chinese propaganda, you can go to policychangeindex.org to learn more about it. Thank you.
Wei Feng Yang from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Wei Feng, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He's been keeping an eye on the Biden administration now hitting the 100-day mark. So, Scott, your impression of the president's first 100 days in office?
Well, thanks for having me back, Loman. I think that the last 100 days been pretty wild. We have certainly seen a lot of partisanship, a lot of progressive ideas coming out of the Biden administration. He initially said during his inauguration that he wanted to breed unity throughout America and heal the country. But I think he's done the complete opposite when it comes to actually putting forward proposals that both political parties can get behind. Joe Biden has largely focused on partisanship through his economic stimulus plan that didn't receive any Republican votes in Congress when they passed that earlier this spring on reconciliation in the House and Senate. That was obviously signed into law. That was the one with the big stimulus checks. And A few weeks ago on the program, we also talked about a $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan that really didn't include a whole lot of money for roads and bridges. So they're trying to figure out exactly how that relates to infrastructure. You know, the whole joke there that love is infrastructure, actually, according to the Democrats. That costs a lot of money. We all know that if you're married. And then we also have we have this week a $1.8 trillion spending plan that they're calling the Families Package. And that's been rolled out with the 100 days in office and this joint session of Congress that Joe Biden spoke this week.
Looking at all this, Scott, we had a couple of $1 trillion with the stimulus package, a couple $1 trillion proposed for infrastructure, a couple $1 trillion proposed this past week. A trillion here, a trillion there. Isn't this all starting to add up to some real money? And how in the world are we affording all of this spending?
$1.9 trillion plus $2.3 trillion plus $1.8 trillion. That equals a big flat $6 trillion of federal spending that Joe Biden is trying to get out the door. Now, obviously, not all of that spending is for the year 2021. It's obviously been a precedent that people put forward 10-year plans, and that's what a lot of this is. But it's still an enormous amount of money when you consider that this is all money on top of normal federal spending that we've got when it comes to Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and the real drivers of the debt and deficit that are structured fundamentally within the entitlement system. So what Biden did this week with a $1.8 trillion spending package for families is really a redistribution of wealth once again to low and middle income families when it comes to child care and education and paid leave and nutrition programs. Unpacking it a little bit, he wants a $200 billion investment in free universal preschool, and he wants over $100 billion to make 2 years of community college free. He wants also to invest $85 billion into Pell Grants that a lot of low and middle income students use to pay for tuition and fees and books and room and board and so on. And so when you talk about all this money that he's trying to direct toward education, and then he wants to put another couple hundred billion dollars toward making child care, quote, more affordable. And then he's also trying to add in paid leave benefits for employees. And then he's also got all this money for nutrition. Like, kids want to eat what they want to eat. And it's hard to get a kid to eat hummus if you've got children. Think about that, too. But one way that he's going to go about trying to pay for at least a fraction of this is dramatically increasing taxes on the highest income earners and those that are successful through their own investment by increasing capital gains all the way up to 39.6% on millionaires. The top marginal rate would also bounce from 37% to 39.6% underneath Joe Biden's plans. These are highly anti-economic growth, anti-competitive structures to the tax code that will only stifle investment, and it'll actually cause more folks to be unemployed. It'll cause less job creation. It'll cause less productivity when it comes to making widgets and various commodities and products. The highest income earners in America largely drive economic activity. And we are a country of high consumption within a really strong middle class, but that middle class is going to be weakened when we basically use the federal government and the force of the tax code to punish those that are actually taking the risk and driving most of the innovation and investment that happens in America. So capital gains and investment taxation dividends, obviously they're trying to target it on millionaires right now. But if you think about it, that's going to affect the entire stock market. And most workers have some sort of an investment portfolio, if it's an IRA or 401k, or maybe some of these young millennials that have got brand new Robinhood account, or maybe they only have a few hundred dollars in it, but they're playing around and learning things about investment. Ultimately, when you increase capital gains taxation, it's going to affect the entire market. And we're going to see a lot of our stocks bought up by people outside of the United States that actually don't pay those capital gains taxation. And we're going to see, I think, just a flowing of investment to foreign sources.
And just to end up today, Scott, the Club for Growth came out with a very important endorsement this past week. Tell us a bit about it, please.
So this week, the Club for Growth PAC endorsed Susan Wright, who is the widow of former U.S. Representative Ron Wright. Ron Wright sadly passed away on February 7th following a long battle with cancer and a short battle with the coronavirus. And so this race is what's called a special election jungle on May 1st, meaning the top two candidates of either party will advance to the runoff election. This week, President Trump also made an endorsement of Susan Wright, so we're feeling confident about her ability to make it into the runoff election, and we're all in it to win it for Susan.
We will continue to keep an eye on that, and we have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We have over 500,000 members from all walks of life. If your listeners want to check us out, the website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Claiming broadband capacity is infrastructure, the Biden administration wants to spend $100 billion to expand the service. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine takes a look at the proposal.
The Biden administration is manufacturing a market failure, or at least the appearance of a market failure, in order to justify spending $100 billion on municipal broadband and other government-run internet projects. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me today. Instead, we're taking a look at this one small nugget buried within this $2.3 trillion infrastructure proposal that the Biden administration rolled out earlier this month. As I said, as part of that plan, President Joe Biden is pushing Congress to spend about $100 billion fixing a problem that mostly doesn't exist. And that problem is, according to the Biden administration, widespread lack of access to broadband internet. Now, the Federal Communications Commission estimates that there were about 14.5 million Americans, or about 4 million households, that lacked access to broadband internet at the end of 2019. Now, that's a serious but actually pretty narrow problem that's already being addressed by a combination of public and private efforts. Some of those efforts are actually really cool, like SpaceX's new low-orbit satellites, part of its Starlink program, that can beam broadband internet to homes, even in far-flung rural places that haven't been able to get access to high-speed internet yet. And the FCC has already budgeted more than $9 billion over the next 10 years as part of what the agency says is the biggest single step ever towards closing the rural digital divide. The number of Americans without broadband access fell by 20% during 2019, and it likely tumbled even further last year. But Biden's infrastructure plan suggests a major change to what counts as broadband internet, and as a result, as many as 64 million American households could suddenly appear to lack adequate online speed, even though nothing about their current services would change. To understand exactly why the Biden administration is doing this and why it matters, you have to first understand just a little bit about how internet speeds are measured and what currently counts as broadband internet. Since 2015, the FCC has defined broadband connections as any internet access with download speeds of at least 25 megabits per second and upload speeds of at least 3 megabits per second. In layman's terms, that's fast enough to stream a high-definition movie in the living room while three other people in your household check Facebook or send email or do some online shopping. This so-called 25-3 connection might not be fast enough for all households. Some people choose to buy faster internet, of course, but it is a standard that's meant to reflect the needs of most Americans. It's sort of a baseline for what we should expect. The higher download speeds relative to upload speeds are a reflection of what consumers demand. The vast majority of internet usage involves downloading. After all, that's largely due to the huge demand for streaming video out there. But even after the big surge in upload demand during 2020, thanks to everyone working from home and doing all those Zoom calls, still about 93% of all internet traffic to households involves downloading content, not uploading it. So that's why there's a big difference there. But the White House is now pushing for what it is calling a future-proof broadband infrastructure, and that term has specific meaning in the technology world. Future-proof network usually means symmetric speeds. It means that the Biden administration is aiming for upload and download speeds to be the same, and not just the same, but much faster than they are now. In fact, the Biden administration and many of its allies are pushing for a 100-100 standard. That would be 100 megabits per second for both uploads and downloads. Now, that's just kind of silly as a baseline standard. A typical Zoom call, for example, uses about 1.5 megabits per second. Scott Walston, the president of the Technology Policy Institute, tells me that with a 100-100 connection, you could have 10 kids pretending to do Zoom school but actually doing TikTok, while you're in the other room pretending to work but actually watching Netflix, and you still wouldn't run out of bandwidth. It's just way more than the average household needs. Politically, however, defining broadband connections as 100-100 would mean two significant things. First of all, it would radically change the number of Americans who currently have what is considered to be a broadband connection, and that would bolster calls for government intervention in the marketplace. There are approximately 4.3 American households that don't have access to a 25-3 connection, but there are 64 million households that don't currently have access to a 100-100 connection. In other words, we would suddenly be faced with the government statistics that show 64 million households lack sufficient internet connectivity, even though almost all of those households already have access to broadband-level speed. Secondly, this maneuver would allow for a bit of political favoritism because it would prioritize fiber optic internet services over the alternatives that have sprouted up. There are lots of different ways you can get a broadband internet connection at 25.3 speeds. Cable connections do that, so do fixed wireless, and even those low-orbit satellite systems like the Starlink service that I mentioned earlier. But there's really only one way to get reliable 100-100 speed, and that is via fiber optic cable. Of course, fiber internet is also one of the more costly and difficult types of internet service from the perspective of infrastructure. It requires digging trenches, laying pipes, and physically connecting each and every household. It is a practical impossibility for rural parts of the country and tends to be more expensive elsewhere. That's a big problem if you're in the business of providing internet service to people as quickly and cost-effectively as possible, but it's an opportunity if you're looking to spend lots of government money on a high-profile infrastructure plan. Put another way, if there are suddenly 64 million American households without access to good internet under the Biden administration's new definition, then broadband providers will have to focus their upgrade efforts on areas with dense populations. That means that they'll likely crowd out efforts to reach households that still lack even 25.3 connections, and once again, the rural parts of the country will be left behind. In the end, this means that the Biden administration could end up manufacturing a market failure and justifying the spending of $100 billion to supposedly bridge the proverbial digital divide, and then discover that the divide has just gotten bigger than ever. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of the Biden administration, including everything from this week's State of the Union address that wasn't really a State of the Union address, at Reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
We welcome Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council as our newest American Radio Journal commentator. He talks about winners and losers in reapportionment on his first commentary.
The U.S. Census Bureau just announced its long-anticipated list of state winners and losers from the official 2020 census this week. With good reason, this is huge news for policymakers in Washington, D.C., in our 50 state capitals, as the news brings with it major implications for the 2022 congressional midterms, state political clout, and future presidential elections. Beyond the political themes, which will clearly get the most mainstream media attention, the census results tell us an essential story from a public policy perspective, and that is the story of relative economic competitiveness across our 50 states, or as Justice Brandeis would put it, the laboratories of democracy. Americans continue to vote with their feet towards states that have lower tax burdens and value economic competitiveness. For more than a decade at ALEC, our work at Rich States, Poor States has revealed that states with lower taxes, especially those that avoid personal income taxes altogether, have seen significantly better rates of in-migration than states with high income tax rates and big government policies. As expected, Texas is the big winner of this census report, as they were the only state across America to gain more than one new U.S. congressional seat. Texas remains a great example for how to avoid an income tax, have a free market policy, and enjoy the economic benefits of those efforts. In fact, recently, the Lone Star State wisely banned a personal income tax in their state constitution. They thought it was that important. As we have pointed out for many years, there was an abundance of academic research supporting the idea that taxes and the quest for economic opportunity are significant drivers of migration across states. On the other hand, the new census report outlined that high-tax states, such as Illinois, California, Pennsylvania, and New York, all lost congressional representation. For New York, this represents yet another loss in congressional representation. Going back to the census of 1940, when the Empire State had 45 U.S. House members, it is simply shocking that today New York will only have 26 House seats going forward for this coming decade. One of the most significant stories from the new census report comes at the expense of California. For the first time in state history, the Golden State will lose a congressional seat. California continues suffering a mass exodus due to taxpayers voting with their feet across state lines. Net domestic outmigration, the hundreds of thousands of former California taxpayers who have departed for one of the other 49 states, is really the driving factor for their loss of this congressional seat. Californians are leaving behind high taxes, unaffordable living, and draconian government lockdowns. Texas is the largest recipient, with an estimated 86,000 former Californians moving to the Lone Star State in 2018 alone. Looking at polling data, this migration of Californians to other states shows no signs of stopping. University of California at Berkeley polling shows more than half of California voters polled had thought about leaving California for another state. Of the voters polled, a full 71% cited high housing costs and 58% cited high taxes as their motivation for wanting to move. Even California's sunny weather, beautiful mountains, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood can't keep people around if their economic environment deteriorates enough. Americans continue to vote with their feet in response to uncompetitive state economic policies. As economic theory suggests, if taxes drive up the cost of living in one state, then states with lower taxes become that much more attractive places to live and work and raise a family. As our Alec Laffer, Rich States, Poor States, Golden Rules of Effective Taxation states, if A and B are two locations, and if taxes are raised in B and lowered in A, producers and manufacturers and hardworking taxpayers will have a greater incentive to move from B to A. As my co-author Art Laffer likes to say, this isn't rocket surgery, this is economics 101. This migration of taxpayers from high-tax states to low-tax states is this economic theory coming true. State policymakers would be wise to recognize how that economic policy drives individual decision-making across states. If states want to become more attractive to new residents and job creators, making the tax and economic policy more competitive for all is really a prerequisite. This is Jonathan Williams for American Radio Journal. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WLSC-AM in Loras, South Carolina, WZSK-AM in Everett, Pennsylvania, along with WGVY-AM in Alta Vista, Virginia. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.